This podcast may contain disturbing content for some listeners. It's intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. This is True Crime XS.
A serial killer the FBI describes as addicted to murder.
The killings were completely random.
A man who lived two very different lives.
As he murdered victim after victim, we don't even know how many.
Tonight, the FBI now believes confessed serial killer took 11 lives. That's up from their previous count of 8. The FBI is also releasing a new detailed multi-year timeline. The 34-year-old committed suicide while in prison in Alaska, but before he died, he confessed to killing Bill and Lorraine Currier of Essex, Vermont.
Bill and Lorraine Currier of Essex, Vermont were forcibly abducted from their home in June of 2011 and murdered.
Do you remember where you were Thanksgiving 1997? Because that's really where this story began. And the revelation sort of ended for me in summer of 2010. The rest of the story, it's already been told. It's the events of those two time periods and the dots that connect them that encompass the story I'm telling 10 years later. I could tell you all about serial killers and the etymology behind the word serial and murder, but if you found your way here, I'm assuming you already know these things. You might even, like me, have your own ideas about certain killers we're on a first-name basis with in our world. Ted, Ed, Jeffrey, Dean, John Wayne, Dennis, Jack, Harold, Pedro, H.H., or you might know them as Raider, Gacy, Coral, Dahmer, Bundy, Kemper. Back in 2012, I added a new name to my repertoire. I'm not going to say it. I've said it enough. But I'm going to tell a story around the name. And here's a name I will say, because it's an important one. Samantha.
Good evening, everyone. The massive search for missing barista Samantha Koenig is over, but it's not the news family and friends were hoping for.
Earlier today, a forensic dive team discovered in Matanuska Lake what investigators believed to be the body of Samantha Koenig.
I'm not going to rehash the details of Samantha's story. You can read all of her story elsewhere. Other people, for better or worse, have covered her story endlessly. It's unlikely in my lifetime that there will ever be a moment in time that someone somewhere is not Googling her name and discovering her story for the very first time. But I have a different thought. Samantha is not just a victim of some rapist and killer. Samantha, a barista in Alaska on a cold, dark February night, is a hero for the ages. She doesn't even know it. You see, Samantha, she slayed a dragon that night in February. And like many heroes in the world, she's unassuming. I remember reading the news of her abduction and wondering if it was her father or her ex-boyfriend or her boyfriend or some random guy from her high school or a transient that might be responsible for her abduction. But we knew one thing for sure. We know she wasn't responsible for her own disappearance because there was video evidence. Her predator was on video. Even if he was still unknown for 63,360 minutes after the video was released. And then he was trapped in a cage of his own making. He chose to kill himself in that cage instead of showing us the real him. And no matter the ending to her story, Samantha ended a reign of terror in the United States and in Canada, Mexico, and Belize. Unlike anything the best behavioral analysts in the world have ever seen. And now a moment of silence to remember that sacrifice. It may seem like an unusual way to kick off a podcast, but this is not a usual podcast. The story I'm about to tell you is not unlike what a lot of other people are doing at home right now. People hunting the missing, people hunting killers, delving into the darkest corners of the internet to try and find genetic matches for cold cases. And I'm not just talking about law enforcement and private investigators and scientists, I'm talking about you. You could be the key to solving the next case you come across on a podcast or in a news report, or while perusing your favorite website, because that's exactly what happened to me. What I'm about to play is part of a long clip, and it's a clip of the killer talking to two representatives of the U.S. Attorney General's office, a special agent from the FBI, and a homicide detective from Anchorage, Alaska. But what's really in this clip is everything. He sets up a set of rules here. This is on April 6, 2012, after him being arrested in Lufkin, Texas. And what he's doing here sets off a chain of events that begins with the death of Samantha, but ends with a similarity to the case of Holly Bobo.
And you're not sitting around the table with us on other cases, on other bodies. We don't.
Well, okay, that's it. Here's the deal. I know what you have, because I know you have the computer.
Right, and I've got maps. I'm never going to bluff you, Israel, okay? I've got maps that I know come up with a bunch of other states, okay? I've got Washington, Texas, Utah, Montana. I could list them out for you. I didn't bring them all here today.
I know what's on that computer. Okay. I know what you have. I know as time goes by, the longer I'm in the system, the longer the investigation goes on, you're going to keep finding things. You're going to start to connect dots. I'm only going to give you the dots that I know you're going to eventually connect. Basically what's on that computer. And frankly, if I hadn't been picked up in Texas, that computer would be in the landfill right now because I was going to get Kimberly March 24th, a new computer. So I'm telling you that that's all.
You're a smart guy. I get it.
But I'm not going to talk about those things that I know you're eventually going to connect me to unless I know that I'm going to get what I want. And I don't know if that's possible.
Tell me what you want. I don't know what you want.
It's related to that case. So.
Well, tell me what you want. If that case didn't exist and we were going to connect the dots on other bodies, tell me what you would want.
I want an execution date.
For you?
Yes. I want this whole thing wrapped up and over with as soon as possible.
Well, I can start to work on things.
And so begins the killer's demands, I guess you'd call it. He's basically demanding that Assistant U.S. Attorney General Kevin Feldes give him the death penalty. Oh, and that other case he's talking about that they're not allowed to talk about, that's Samantha's case. They were all under gag order to not talk about it while he was represented by counsel. But he kept trying to explain to them that all of the cases, including the ones on his computer and Samantha's, are connected. And I believe him. With this story, it's really easy to get lost in just playing the FBI interviews or reading off the tips. But I'm not going to do that.
One thing, if we can somehow connect everything together, then there's little doubt that I'm going to get what I want in my mind. I don't know the way the system
works. Please understand, if you want an attorney here, we're going to call one right now, right here. Okay.
No, I don't. You're
this April 6, 2012 interview is linked in the show notes. It really is high drama. It's worth listening to if you want to know more about the killer. But that's really all that we can get out of it. He does tell us that he's not going to tell the FBI anything that's not on his computer. He knows they're going to start connecting dots, and that's really what he's expecting them to talk to him about. The thing is, it's now 2020. And no one has connected those dots, at least not publicly. These interviews are long. They span from April into just days before his death. I've been listening to that voice since the first release of any of his audio. I've heard newscasters say his name. He even pops up reference in episodes of television shows like Criminal Minds. I don't have to say his name ever again, and neither do you. I've divided my story of this killer into 10 major parts, 2 episodes each. I had to organize this story. And if I'm honest, at first, I didn't know how to tell it, but other people did. The questions I asked myself here, after listening to that clip, were what the hell was on that computer? And more importantly, what wasn't on that computer? And why not just tell him you'll execute him? What the hell had this guy done that he wanted so badly to hide it? Over the last few years, I listened to theories, online, in person. I read this killer could be connected to every missing persons case that had ever been opened, and none of them. And then I heard that his case was closed. Completely. No more announcements. 4 known victims, and nothing else. Was the FBI hiding something? I briefly thought, what if he's still alive? What if he's being held in some deep, dark hole, slowly spilling his secrets? Armchair Monday morning detectives say things like, how did they bungle this interrogation so badly? But they didn't. This is less than 4 weeks after capturing what is probably the scariest monster the FBI and the entire world has ever seen. Operating for 14 years, unseen and unknown, and showing a new type of killer in an age where digital is the new analog and analog is the new digital. Because this killer is so paranoid about being caught or even talked to by law enforcement that he covers his tracks better than any killer we've ever seen. But I wondered, how are they all connected? That was the big question for me. This decompensating sociopath had dropped our hero's remains into an icy lake and given the FBI a couple's remains in a torn-down abandoned farmhouse in Vermont. How is this indicative of some type of new predator? And who is this prey? These are the questions I started to ask myself. These are the things that sent me back down the rabbit hole that is the crime span of this killer. But what I really wanted to know, the thing that bothered me the most, where the hell are the bodies? I didn't have anyone to ask this question. I wanted to know where the bodies were buried, so I reached out to a couple of people I knew, and one of them responded and started down the investigative path with me. But hold on a minute. I'm going to play a little bit of our scripted efforts to tell you this story.
So where we're at is on page 4.
Okay. Do you not have... I'm sorry. What? Go ahead.
What were you saying?
I was going to say, do you not have it? Is it in your handwriting? Because I could send you this back over.
No.
Hey, some earlier conversations when we were first trying to figure out the format and design of this podcast between myself and an internet researcher named Meg. Once you hear these conversations, you'll hear how we sort of got started down the rabbit hole of recording our investigations into this case.
Interrogators literally where the bodies are buried. Was it subtle?
Maybe. I mean, define subtle. This guy was not a super secret genius. He sort of told what he wanted when he wanted. Really, he was just a killer. He was just a criminal. He thinks he has his little stories all kept to himself, and he may have some of the details, but I really think we can figure out the important part.
So what's an important part here?
The bodies. The only thing that matters now is bringing the bodies home. The rest of it is just nonsense.
Now, this killer has been covered in some little mini documentaries, and he's been covered on a lot of true crime podcasts. There's several books that have been researched and written about him, and I'm along for the ride here sort of wrangling the story that we're putting out. But in your own words, Meg, what makes this part of the story, our part of the story, different?
Well, we weren't bound by the same parameters that the interviewers with the local police, the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office were when they were interviewing him. We were never going to be sitting in a courtroom where a defense team was rebutting what we put out, and we were never going to be subject to that scrutiny. So I think it takes the pressure off any investigating we're doing.
And we didn't have to sit in the room with a guy and be face-to-face with the killer for hours and days.
Right. And he gave them everything. He just did it in such a random way that it made it nearly impossible to piece it together in a way that they or anyone else would have bothered to follow up on.
Do you think he was he playing a game or was he lying?
No, I don't think it was a game. I don't think he lied outright either. He definitely misled and later even admitted to misleading the people trying to investigate his case. But he treated his interview the same way he treated a lot of his crime scenes.
Oh yeah, how's that?
In some instances, he would move vehicles around. He would make sure he had alibied himself, and he would even have communication with loved ones. He kept a tight timeline. The financial records they have for him are convenient at times and infuriating at other times. The FBI, as they got involved, sort of evolved to the opinion that they were dealing with something pretty serious and monstrous.
What makes you think that you have found the bodies?
I'd say it's a group effort, mainly so I can blame you for any snafus along the way.
You know what? I'll share the blame. If we can accurately locate a single body with what I think is the best hypothesis I've heard about this case, I will take the blame, all of it, the whole thing.
I don't think you're going to have to. Telling this story is important. There are a lot of loved ones who have wondered, what if? And the bodies are in places that they need to be retrieved from and put in a proper resting place.
We're making some really big promises here. Where are the bodies buried? Give us a hint.
Well, for the most part, they aren't.
What does that even mean?
It depends on your definition of buried.
Okay, but will we be able to find them?
There should be something.
This was a carefully scripted effort using the killer's own words to describe what it was that we were doing. Ultimately, we decided that even for a true crime podcast, the material was too dry and we were trying too hard to make jokes to offset the dryness. So we had to abandon that format. And even though I can't play the entire audio here, what I am going to play is the relevant portion that sets a tone for this incredibly complicated spider's web of a case. So bear with me, I'll get it all out. I think I will, at least.
Well, I'll just have to wait and see then. This is a massive story. It spans 14 years. So how do we tell it?
I've been thinking about that. And the story really has to be told in parts. Part of it is chronological. Part of it is sort of a prologue, except the prologue is really the end of the story.
Yeah, but if it's the end of the story, then it would be an epilogue. We're really telling an epilogue then.
But an epilogue happens because you've heard the story and a footnote is being placed at the end to explain something. I've got an epilogue for this story, but it's really a prologue.
Okay, so I guess let's begin.
I like to think that I'm a pretty logical person. I follow things closely.
If it sounds a little like we're reading from a script, it's because we are.
Case where he was asking me if a serial killer who said he didn't kill kids might make an exception if they were looking to make someone with them a target. I asked him what he was looking at, and he explained to me that he was looking at a case in California to rule out a possibility in Philly. To say I was confused is a massive understatement. So he had this missing persons case where it was the mom and her kid. The mom had been charged much later with parental kidnapping, but one of the kids showed back up when they were of age, and we were basically ruling them out because in this particular case, it seemed like they were alive. I asked him to point me to the other case, and it was the 2005 disappearance of Danielle Imbo and Richard Petrou. It was a pretty fascinating case, and it's an important story to me because it was about these people who vanished at Valentine's over a decade before our conversation took place. I thought that something had to have been missed and that there was an obvious solution. So I started reading about the case. There's a lot of speculation about their case on the internet. And I was like, why aren't you following this case? And the text comes back to me saying, oh, I was trying to rule out this killer, who is my go-to for couples in the 2000s. And I decided to start looking closer at the Imbo case.
Every so often, a filmmaker or a podcaster in the true crime arena will try to tell the story of Danielle Imbo and Richard Petrou. It's a compelling one. It's a modern WTF mystery. And there are so many unknowns that it's really hard to make a story about it all that isn't wildly speculative. And I knew that I was doing just that. And I also knew that the killer I was researching gets thrown out there for a lot of missing persons cases and real whodunits. I was looking at them for some real specific reasons. Their disappearances have so many websites and stories surrounding it. There was a rumored suspect, and I don't think I was ever going to be able to find them or to find out exactly what happened to them, but I wanted to at least talk about them and research them, even if I knew that a conclusion couldn't come right away. Maybe not ever. And the general circumstances and accounts, it goes something like this. Richard was 35 years old at the time of his disappearance. He lived in Pennsylvania, and he worked at his parents' bakery. He had a daughter who was 14 years old at the time he disappeared. Now, Danielle, she was 34 years old at that time, and had a son who I think was only 1 year old. The two were family friends and they'd been dating on and off throughout the years. Danielle was in the process of separating from her husband and she needed some space to figure things out and settle the divorce. So she ended things with Richard a few weeks before their disappearance. Richard seemed to understand and the pair did not speak until a couple of weeks later on February the 19th, 2005. Richard was alone eating at a bar in South Philadelphia. He was thinking of people that he could call to come have some drinks with. He called his sister, and she informed him that she was having a ladies' night. She was out with their mother, their longtime friends, Felice Atobre, and her daughter, Danielle Imbo. Richard's sister decided that she did not want to meet with him at the bar, but asked Danielle if she wanted to go. And Danielle said yes. So Danielle went to meet Richard for some drinks, and they met up and drove in Richard's black Dodge Dakota truck to a bar called Abilene's in South Philadelphia. People who had seen the two at the bar that night say the pair were sitting close and they were smiling at each other and laughing and even kissing, and they were just talking about their plans. They seemed to be having a good time. So they decided to leave, and they were headed to Danielle's condo around 11:45 p.m. Richard was going to drop Danielle off at her condo and then go back to his house. The two then walked out of the bar to Richard's truck and were never seen again. And both of the families were immediately worried when neither person showed up that night or the following day. Danielle had a hair appointment that morning that she missed. They tried calling both of their cell phones, and both went straight to voicemail. Now, Danielle's brother decided to stop by her condo because he had a key. And when he got there, her place was dark and assumed undisturbed, like no one had been there. Danielle's son was being dropped off that day around 3. So her family assumed that that was when they would see her again. So when she didn't show up to get her son, her family immediately knew that something was seriously wrong. And she loved her son. She was never going to miss picking him up. And that night, Danielle's brother and Richard's father drove all around the city looking for any sign of Danielle or Richard. So after a long night, no results, they returned home. Friends and neighbors began the search as well, and they had posters and flyers of the couple and Richard's truck with the license plate number and the exact model of the car. The family even paid for a helicopter to take them up and search the entire area. A police officer told Danielle's brother that they will never find anything because it's just too clean, which was a pretty disturbing statement. But police tracked their cell phones, tracked their bank accounts, and nothing ever turned up.
With that, I was sucked in. Now, full disclaimer, this is how I got involved, and this particular case is one that I haven't gotten to the end of. So I don't want to mislead any listener to me telling it to imply that I know what happened to this couple. This is just the rabbit hole I went with that led to where we are now. When I started looking, I thought, they're in the river. They had to have gone into the water between Philadelphia and Camden, the Delaware. And I thought, surely law enforcement or the family or search parties would find them if that had happened. The next thing was, okay, where's the spouses or exes? And there was a theory that her ex was involved, but he had a pretty rock solid alibi that ended up making it all look like a hit. So after getting this deep, I asked, why are you looking at a killer and couples, and what are you talking about?
Well, one of the things that interests me is when I see a case that's like a vanishing and that has more than one person involved and or vehicles might be involved. I was also dealing with like all these circles on a map. And oh, they were on his computer.
I was like, wait, what? They're on a computer. What are you talking about? Then he sent me this list. It had a lot of names on it. I wanted immediately to know all about it, where this list came from. It turns out there was a couple of computers involved. There was a computer from his house. His girlfriend had a computer. He had a computer in the car when he was arrested. And then shortly after this conversation, but I think before I was fully invested in investigating this story, I think to get my interest, he sends me these FBI files. And they had a lot of information and also zero information. You can sometimes sift through hundreds of pages just to find out things that the FBI did in terms of going to a lecture.
In the searches on the computers, the FBI had compiled images from the caches and temporary files that had a lot of people, their images in there, that they soon realized were people from the news.
That stupid computer. What does a dragon keep in his lair? In his book, An Instinct for Dragons, anthropologist David Jones suggests a hypothesis that humans, just like monkeys, have an inherited instinctive reactions to snakes, large cats, and birds of prey. He cites a study which found that approximately 39 people out of 100 are afraid of snakes. He notes that fear of snakes is especially prominent in children, even in areas where snakes are rare. The earliest attested dragons all resemble snakes or bear snake-like attributes. Jones therefore concludes that the reason why dragons appear in nearly all cultures is because of humans' innate fear of snakes and other animals that were major predators of humans' primate ancestors. Dragons are usually said to reside in dank caves, deep pools, wild mountain reaches, sea bottoms, haunted forests, all places which would have been fraught with danger for early human ancestors. Humans no longer fear dragons. The Jabberwocky from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. He appears almost comical. Dragons appear in the Game of Thrones, in The Hobbit. Not dragons like the Snollygaster, or the Partridge Creek Monster, or the Last Dragon, but things that represent honest-to-God human fear. I've labeled this killer as a dragon because he's almost become that. He's almost become myth. He's almost become legend. But the truth is, with stories like the Snollygaster and Bigfoot and things that lurk in the wilderness that explain vanishings and disappearances, is that it's almost always a very real human to fear as its origin. But now I find myself asking the question, what does this dragon keep on that stupid computer? I can't help but imagine bones laying on a rock floor, waiting for someone to discover the victims. But Meg's later observations about the video surveillance from Samantha's taking and its comparisons to Holly Bobo is what really made me realize we needed to tell this story.
Well, this isn't some psychic mumbo jumbo I'm dealing with here. I'm dealing with a probability that is pretty strong. And it's been over 7 years since this guy died. I don't think someone else is thinking the same way we have in order to find these locations. And they cover some pretty high profile instances of sudden vanishings and disappearances.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of, you know, Holly Bobo was in there.
You mean on his computer?
Well, her picture was on there.
I know that's a case for you. I looked at it. I'm torn, but I did notice some things. Some of them have been mentioned elsewhere, but one of them, I think, has been missed. And it's a part that I think is setting up our victim's type. So it makes me think she fits, even though I think I don't want to try and get involved in cases where there are legal processes and convictions. But take it away, and I'll tell you what I noticed.
Well, I have a couple of Tennessee cases.
Well, I can definitely put him at least once, maybe twice in the area that you looked at down there. Start with just Holly Bobo because her face was in the matching documents.
At the time of her disappearance, Holly Bobo was a 20-year-old nursing student in the licensed practical nurse program at the University of Tennessee at the Martin Parsons Center in Parsons, Tennessee. She was living with her parents and her brother in Darden. Friends described her as shy and sweet. We have a timeline of the events on the day of her disappearance on April 13, 2011. It's based off of witness statements and reported phone records. At 4:30 a.m., Holly woke up to study for an exam. And then around 7:30 a.m., Holly answered a call from her boyfriend, Drew Scott, who was turkey hunting nearby on her grandmother's property. Holly's parents had left for work by this point, and her brother, Clint, was still asleep. At 7:42 a.m., Holly made her last cell phone call. After this point, all the phone calls and texts were incoming and unanswered. So at some point after this call ended, a neighbor heard a scream from the Bobo residence, and then the neighbor called his mother to tell her about the scream, who called Karen Bobo at work at 7:46 a.m. Then at 7:50 a.m., Clint was awakened by the family dogs barking, and he saw a man with Holly outside. And the quote is, "It appeared to be Holly kneeling down and Drew Scott. They looked like they were kneeled down facing each other in the garage, and they were talking back and forth. Holly sounded very upset and heated. He was doing much of the talking. She would answer back and things like that. I couldn't make out hardly any of the words. The only words I could make out from her were Holly saying, 'No, why?' Clint said that he believed that the couple was breaking up. And at some point, Karen called home and spoke to Clint. And she said that I said, 'Clint, that's not Drew. Get a gun and shoot him.' Clint reportedly replied, 'You want me to shoot Drew?' Still believing that the man was Holly's boyfriend. And at 7:55 a.m., Karen called 911. But because she was calling from work, she reached the dispatcher for the wrong county. And at home, Clint looked outside again around this time and saw the man dressed in camouflage walking with Holly into the woods. And at this point, he noted that the man with Holly was larger than Drew Scott. He tried to call Holly's cell phone as well as Drew Scott's cell phone, but neither call was answered. And then at 8 a.m., Karen called her house again, and Clint told her what he saw, and she instructed him to call 911. Clint got a loaded pistol, and he went outside, and there he found bloodstains belonging to Holly in the carport. He dialed 911. Police began to arrive at the Bobo residence around 8:10 a.m., and at 8:17 a.m., cell phone pings showed that Holly's cell phone was moving away from her home tower, and it was headed north. Her cell phone continued north to a wooded area near Interstate 40, where her remains were eventually found. From 8:30 to 9 a.m., the cell phone stopped moving for 20 to 30 minutes, and then the cell phone began traveling south again using a different route. And at 9:25 a.m., the last cell phone ping came from Holly's phone in the area where her phone and its SIM card were later found. Clint described the man as being between 5'10 and 6 feet tall, weighing 180 to 200 pounds, and having dark hair sticking out from under his cap that was long enough to cover his neck and touch his collar. Clint said the man was wearing a hat and camouflage clothing from head to toe and identified the pattern as either mossy oak breakup or leafy wear. He described the male voice he heard as very deep and low. Now, extensive searches of the area were conducted following Bobo's disappearance. Several items belonging to Bobo were found scattered throughout the town, including her lunchbox, a receipt with her name on it, a card from school, her cell phone, the SIM card, which had been removed from the cell phone. And early in the investigation, the Tennessee Bureau of Investigations focused heavily on a registered sex offender who matched the witness description. His name was Terry Britt. His home was wiretapped and searched during the course of the investigation, but he was never charged. And then in September of 2014, Bobo's partial remains were found by ginseng hunters in a wooded area of northern Decatur County in Tennessee, just off I-40, about 20 miles from Darden. The owner of the property said it was not uncommon for people to hunt there without permission. One of the men who found the remains said he saw a large bucket in the woods, which he upturned. Details of the contents have not been released. He then spotted Bobo's remains spread on the ground behind him, and investigators recovered her skull, teeth, several ribs, and one shoulder blade. Her skull had what appeared to be a bullet hole in the back of it on the right side, with a trajectory going left, fracturing her left cheekbone when it exited. And arrests were later made. Several men were said to be involved, and according to the state and the trial, in her abduction or murder.
And there was a white truck involved.
Yeah, there was a white truck seen in the area that was considered to be the lead defendant's truck.
So the trial transcripts and actual video for this case are available online. I have watched some of them, I assume.
All of it. I've seen every single piece of video, every single article. I've read everything that's available about this case.
Anything that stands out that you care to share?
I mean, all of it? Seriously. I'm not saying those cats didn't do it, the people that they've arrested. I'm just saying that something feels wrong and off about the whole situation. It just sort of screams at me that, like, this might be our guy. And I don't think I have any way to prove it because the body's been found.
After his death.
Right.
We should point out these guys haven't just been arrested. They've been convicted. They're in jail.
Yeah. These guys have all been convicted.
I agree with you to a point, but there was a bullet hole in the skull.
I know. So I applied this rule to my finger. The killer stated that he only ever shot Bill Curt, but he also stated that he had already decided he was not going to give any information to his interrogators related to anything before the couriers. Basically, what was on his computer was fair game. If he did it, you know, and if he did this, he left the body out, like it was laying in the woods.
Not necessarily. He may have left the body out, but based on what they found and where, we can't be exactly sure how that went down. A lot of time had passed. Did I read that there was a kill kit found nearby?
Well, so there was a version of a kill kit found nearby. And then there's the bucket that they never released the contents of. And they found a gun that they they pointed back at this crime. It was found in some water near this area.
So in formulating my victims, I'm not going to assume that this is our guy, but I'm going to point out something. It's something I noticed that I didn't need the killer to tell me. It's something I saw him do on a surveillance video.
Okay, so something you saw on a surveillance video made you think of this potential victim and the killer, but they might not be a victim? I don't understand.
Well, the brother repeatedly described, or I heard him repeatedly describing the same time, seeing Holly kneeling in the carport. That's what happened right before the Alaska victim was taken.
Oh, right. In the coffee stand, they had the cameras.
So just to reiterate, someone's already been convicted in the Holly Bobo case. Several someones, in fact. We aren't suggesting anything related to that case except for the fact that she was found on his computer. Her body was found after Samantha Koenig's killer died. And there's a similarity. In the Samantha Koenig abduction video taken from surveillance cameras inside the Common Grounds coffee stand, we see the killer approach, engage in small talk with Samantha, and then he has her turn off the lights and kneel, and he enters the coffee stand, zip ties her, and takes her away. The entire video is around 12 minutes long and is available online. There's no sound, but I'll link the video in the show notes. According to the FBI, what he was telling her was that it was a kidnapping for ransom. That's what he was saying while she was kneeling and being zip-tied before she was taken away. In an interview with Holly Bobo's brother, Clint, Clint described seeing Holly Bobo and another individual kneeling in the family's carport.
I listened just briefly, and I could tell it was a male and a female voice. I never was able to really tell what they were saying. Well, as I listened a little bit closer, I could tell that that was Holly's voice, so I knew it was Holly. So in my mind, the male's voice I knew to be Drew, you know, who is her boyfriend. Holly was knelt down in the garage, and a man in camouflage who I identified as Drew were knelt down in the garage facing each other.
And he later gives the following court testimony.
I looked out, I walked over to the window that overlooks the attached garage, a carport, and as I was approaching that, well, I didn't look at anything really, but as I was approaching that window, I heard voices in the...
Let me interrupt you a few times, okay?
Okay.
Is this a window that is in the house or is it in the door?
It's in the house.
Okay, so there's a window in the back of the house?
Yes.
That looks into the carport or looks out at the detached garage?
It looks into the carport attached to the house.
Okay. So you're looking out of an interior window into the carport?
That's right.
Is that right?
That's right.
Are you able to see?
Well, I raised the blinds slightly and saw the silhouette of two individuals underneath that window kneel down.
Was it dark in that carport, or was it light?
It was fairly dark.
There were blinds down in the window?
Yes.
Did you pull them all the way up, or did you just...
No, I very slightly opened one of the blinds enough where I could see out.
Why'd you do it like that?
Because I heard the voices out in the carport.
Now, this time in the morning, you've just woken up, right? So you're fresh out of sleep to a barking dog. The front of the house, there's nothing. So you walk to the back.
Right.
And you look in this dark front.
Right.
And you said, we're describing what you saw, like the silhouettes of people. Did you see these silhouettes or did you hear voices first?
I was going by what I heard and I was going by the voices. I heard the voices first and then I raised the blind to try to look out the window.
Describe the voices.
Well, it was a male's voice and a female's voice.
Did you actually recognize either of the two voices?
At first, I didn't recognize either voice, but as I listened for just seconds, I could recognize my sister's voice and what I thought was her boyfriend Drew's voice.
And why did you think it was her boyfriend Drew's voice?
Well, because he was the only male figure in Holly's life besides myself and my dad.
So you were making an assumption.
That's right.
And for the record, not everyone is convinced that the people convicted for Holly Bobo's murder were behind it.
I knew that he was wearing camouflage and he had what appeared to be a black object in his hand.
You also described his height and weight and hair color.
I estimated him to be about 5'10 and about 200 pounds.
What color hair?
I really don't remember focusing on his hair.
But you've described it to police as being dark.
Yeah.
People are puzzled by Clint Bobo's account of the abduction. At the time, Tennessee Bureau of Investigation's Terry Dicus is heading up the case.
There were a lot of people that felt very strongly that Clint was lying and that Clint telling the truth would be the secret to solving this case.
It was just question after question after question. Now, of course, they did check me. They said for scratches, and so I took my shirt off.
That was that morning that she disappeared?
Yeah, that was that
suspicion
morning.
Suspicion was that quickly turned toward you? But you were there.
I was there, yeah. I was there, and Holly was not there.
Eventually, Clint is cleared, and investigators turn their attention to another man from the county.
Terry Britt was a registered sex offender who lived fairly close to the Bobo home. He lived also very, very close to where some of her property was found.
The first time I interviewed him, I was like, oh my God, this guy did it. This guy did it. I thought that before I interviewed him, actually.
According to Terry Dicus, Terry Britt did have, for lack of a better term, a type. He liked pretty blonde, blue-eyed girls, and Holly fit that type.
Tell me about Terry Britt.
He is a horrible, horrible human being. He spent the majority of his life in prison for kidnapping and rape. And he absolutely, perfectly matches the description.
But it wasn't Terry Britt that was convicted, and it wasn't Clint Bobo. It was a completely different group of people, and it was characterized as some sort of meth-fueled sexual assault committed by a set of disorganized, spur-of-the-moment killers who not only abducted, raped, and killed her, but also covered it up. In Meg's later description, she wrote that the video surveillance made Holly Bobo a compelling case. The kneeling is the thing that makes her think that we might be onto something there. And she says that she agrees with me in principle that the case for the meth heads doing this is sort of weird, that they're covering up the evidence of the crime really well for also being so methed out that they commit the crime in the first place. But Holly Bobo, also on the killer's computer. So there's that to consider, even though she doesn't fit our theory of where the bodies are buried necessarily. And she got a huge amount of publicity. He said that his crimes had never gotten huge amounts of publicity until around the time of the Couriers case. And that isn't far from this in terms of time, but it still made us question everything that had been going on with the Holly Bobo case. We even considered if it was a possibility the killer may have heard the interview of the brother, and maybe he read about the kneeling and he decided it was something he would incorporate into his kidnapping for ransom shtick. We left the Holly Bobo case on because of its similarities to the Samantha Koenig case, and we moved on to other cases. As the killer stated in the interview I played for you earlier, he was never going to give them all of the information. My theory as to why is because he was embarrassed, not of what he'd done, but of the nickname he would receive when we discovered where he'd been keeping his victims. You see, it seemed uncomfortable for the killer to be putting a body in 2012, February, into an icy lake that he had to cut a hole in the top of. And it made no sense that he ran out of time and left a pair of bodies in the basement of an abandoned farmhouse. If I were a killer hunting in the wilderness, where would I stash my victims? The list of victims associated with this killer may be very, very long, and it may include names of other people you've heard on other podcasts, like Maura Murray, Brianna Maitland. But imagine for just a second that when he was decompensating, he had to find new places to put his victims because of some environmental factor. Imagine he'd gotten so used to where he put his victims in the wilderness that he didn't know what to do in a brand new environment. Where would that place be? What would it look like? How can we get to it? And more importantly, on that stupid computer, is there a map to a dragon's lair? What if I told you that I think there was? What if I told you that the reason he hid most of his crimes is because of the shitty place he put the bodies? He only told them about a murder where he'd left the bodies in a hurry
But what if all the other bodies are in similar places? What if we could find Breonna Maitland, Lauren Spear, and Maura Murray? Maybe even Susie Lyle and Amy Bechtel and Jennifer Kessie. Meg set about developing victim profiles for me, and she came up with 6 that I think are totally valid and useful for this investigation. I've narrowed down what I think are the killer's first acts of violence. And on next week's episode, I'm going to tell you about 3 little girls. I think chronological context and the growth of a serial killer are very important things to look at, and I think with this killer, they've mainly been left out. I've wrestled for hours and hours on end. Is it worse to have a family member or a loved one who's just vanished? Or is it worse to have closure knowing that they met a horrible end with a serial killer? And Meg, once again, came up with the strongest hypothesis I've heard for this killer's first official victim. Remember how I asked you about Thanksgiving of 1997? That's the year we're going back to deal with the chronological context of this serial killer. I've spent the last 7 years reading and listening to everything I could get my hands on, everything other people could get their hands on for me, and I made some startling discoveries about what happened between 1996 and 2010, before the dragon ever got caught and slain, or would it be slayed? I'm going to introduce you to a lot of people you've never heard of. I'm going to take you to a lot of places you've never been, and we're going to take a look in some places that you never would have thought of, all in the name of closing some cold cases, including a couple of cold cases that already have their own podcast, multiple podcasts, and documentaries, and long-form television series, and books upon books upon books. And I've got a few bonus episodes I've picked out to cover cases that are too far out there that maybe I'll release on some kind of bonus service to subscribers. They are all connected. He told us they were, because he was lazy. He just put the bodies in similar places, unless those places weren't available. You and I, we're going investigating. But that's not even the right word. We're going hunting. We're going hunting for secrets. And my research from this episode comes from the internet. Comes from the Charlie Project, Namus.gov, Philadelphia Magazine, and The Strange Outdoors. Thanks for listening today. This podcast was made possible by LabrotiCreations.com. Check out the merchandise and specifically their fun pop pet art custom pieces made from photos of your very own pets. Use the promo code CRIMEXS, that's CRIMEXS, for 20% off a fun, brightly colored, happy piece of art of your own pet at their site, LabrotiCreations.com. That's LabrotiCreations.com. Music in this episode was licensed for True Crime XS. Our theme song today is Indestructible by Noah Smith. We also use The Abyss by Lost Ghost and North Coast by Aaron Sprinkle. You can reach us at our website, truecrimexs.com, and you can leave us a voice message at 252-365-5593. Thanks for listening. Please like and subscribe if you want to hear more. You can come over to patreon.com and check out what we've got going on there. If you'd like to donate to fund future True Crime XS road trip investigations and FOIA requests. We'd also like to thank Anchor and Spotify for having the coolest all-in-one podcast platforms available. Definitely download the Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to start your own show today.